content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Welcome. I'm Deborah Love for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues, bringing you information from respected sources about health matters that may be helpful for you or for those you care about in consultation with your healthcare provider. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from a variety of sources that I'll name as we go along. So this first article, in honor of the final week of Heart Month, is falling in the category of what I call the Mythbusters features that I like to share with you. It's from Health Headlines from Novant Health, and it's the five things that movies didn't tell you about heart attacks, setting the record straight on common misconceptions. Most of us know the basics of what a heart attack looks like. Someone clutches their chest and falls to the floor, right? Wrong. Despite what popular movies show, this isn't how most heart attacks happen. A 2024 study looking at portrayals of heart attacks in movies found that movies get a lot wrong, and many of us believe outdated information about heart attacks. Here to set the record straight on five key misconceptions is cardiovascular disease specialist Dr. Desiree Dawson of Novant Health Heart and Vascular Institute, Steel Creek. 1. Heart attack usually starts with discomfort, not drama. A heart attack is the name for a medical condition when blood flow to the heart is suddenly blocked. The two most common symptoms of heart attacks shown in movies are suddenly falling to the floor and losing consciousness. But these aren't common heart attack symptoms in real life. Most people experience mild pain or discomfort at first, rather than a sudden onset of dramatic pain. For some, these symptoms start in the weeks leading up to a heart attack, including being more tired or weaker than usual, feeling chest pain or tightness, feeling shortness of breath, not being able to exercise like usual, having new acid reflux symptoms, feeling anxious, or feeling a faster heartbeat or fluttering in their chest. Others don't experience symptoms until the heart attack begins, when they feel a continuous or periodic squeezing or pain in the chest, nausea or indigestion, shortness of breath, sweating or clamminess, anxiety, lightheadedness or dizziness, or pain in the arm or arms, back, jaw, neck, or stomach. Women in particular are more likely to have fewer classical symptoms like nausea, vomiting, or a feeling of tiredness, while men are more likely to have classical symptoms like chest pain and shortness of breath. It's rare to lose consciousness. Usually a person can communicate about their symptoms. If someone suddenly collapses and is unresponsive, they may be experiencing sudden cardiac arrest, a more serious and fatal heart condition. 2. Clogged arteries aren't the only cause for heart attacks. Someone in the U.S. has a heart attack every 40 seconds. You're probably familiar with the most common reason for heart attacks, coronary artery disease. That's when fatty deposits called plaque build up or clog the arteries. And when a deposit of plaque inside the arteries breaks off and forms a clot that reduces or blocks the blood flow to the heart, that causes a heart attack. But not all heart attacks are caused by coronary artery disease. There are other conditions and events that can cause a heart attack, including a coronary spasm, a coronary artery embolism, a clot formed inside the heart, or spontaneous coronary artery dissection, or SCAD. These are more common causes in women and those under 65 years old. There's also a spectrum of heart attack severity, including the silent or mild heart attack, where there's a partial rather than total blockage of the artery. 3. Young people aren't exempt. If you're under 65, you're not off the hook. We regularly have young patients coming into the emergency room with heart attacks and cardiac arrest, Dawson said. In general, she said patients are looking older, but at much younger ages, due to family history, higher rates of hypertension, diabetes, and other risk factors in younger populations. Dawson's observations reflect national statistics, which find that those having heart attacks are increasingly younger. In one large multi-state study, 30% of those hospitalized with a heart attack were 35 to 54 years old. 4. Don't wait to see if you feel better. Now is the time to go see a doctor. Since symptoms can be mild, you may not feel a sense of urgency to get help, but you should, especially if you are experiencing multiple symptoms, and especially if you've been diagnosed with heart disease already or have risk factors like high blood pressure, high cholesterol, smoking, having type 1 or type 2 diabetes, obesity or being overweight, stress, an unhealthy diet, excessive alcohol use, a family history of heart disease, lack of regular exercise, using a medication that increases your risk of blood clots, or age. The older you are, the more your risk goes up. Don't write it off, "Oh, it's menopause," or "I'm just going through one of those spells again," Dawson said. Instead of just guessing, "It's nothing," we would rather you come get checked out. Let us put the pieces together. You deserve to get the workup done. She said cardiologists use the phrase, "Time is heart muscle." This means that if you delay treatment during a heart attack, you could damage more of your heart muscle. So, if you suspect that you are having a heart attack, call 911. That way, emergency medical services can start treating you on the way to the hospital if needed and avoid wasting time, Dawson said. The 911 operator may tell you to chew and swallow an aspirin while you wait. If you're helping someone with a suspected heart attack, call 911 for them, but don't let them work themselves up, Dawson advises. Remind them that help is on the way and try to stay calm yourself. If you found them unconscious, or if they go unconscious while you're with them, put 911 on speaker, check their pulse, and if you don't get a pulse, begin chest compressions until EMS arrives. 5. The good news. If you get to a hospital quickly, heart attacks aren't as deadly as they used to be. Since 1950, the death rate from heart attack has dropped by 89%, thanks to an improved understanding about the cause of heart attacks and the urgency of treatment and more targeted treatments. You should still aim to avoid having one, though, especially because many who survive a heart attack eventually experience heart failure down the road. To lower your risk, see your primary care doctor yearly for testing and make sure to follow their recommendations. Dawson said, adding, "You've got to help yourself." Dawson has worked with many patients who have made lifestyle changes after their first heart attack, hoping to prevent a future one. Most of the time they say, "Why did I wait so long? It was stupid. I got a wake-up call, and I'm glad I did." Although changing their lifestyle may be hard and takes time, she said, they say they're living better, feel better, and they wish they'd done this sooner. Our last article reminded us that heart attacks are happening to younger and younger people. This article tells us we're never too young to develop a healthy mindset about aging, which may, in fact, slow the aging process. It's in BBC Focus by David Robson. How to Build the Mindset Now, Proven to Slow Aging. How much could a change of attitude change your life? Think for a moment about your hopes and fears for the future. Do you see your 60s, 70s, or 80s as a time of growth and opportunity? While aging brings wisdom, status, will aging bring wisdom, status, and friendship? Or do you see yourself becoming more lonely, hopeless, and grumpy as you get older? Will the last years of your life be, in the words of Shakespeare, mere oblivion, sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans everything? Quite incredibly, those beliefs may predict how you fare in the decades ahead, determining everything from the health of your memory to your risk of cardiovascular disease through a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. Your views about aging may even influence your lifespan by as much as 7.5 years. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, though, and few are as extraordinary as this. But many scientists from across the world are coming to the same conclusion. Your mindset can shape your biology. The topic has been studied for the past 20 to 30 years, and we now have a lot of consistent evidence, says Dr. Serena Sabatini, a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Barcelona in Spain and visiting professor at the University of Surrey in the UK. It's one study after the other, all showing the same results. Dr. Matthew Hill, an assistant professor of sport and exercise sciences at Coventry University in the UK, agrees the evidence base is pretty robust. Unpacking the mechanisms behind this link between mind and body could offer new strategies to enhance the health of our aging population. And if we want to live a long and happy life, it may never be too early to put those principles into practice themselves. So, lighting the touch paper. Dr. Becca Levy, a professor of public health and psychology, lit the touch paper of this research at the turn of the millennium. As a graduate student, she had spent a semester in Japan, thanks to a fellowship from the U.S. National Science Foundation. The country was famous for its population's extraordinary longevity, and immersing herself in this culture, she was struck by how much reverence the Japanese paid to their oldest citizens. Could the two be linked? At that point, I suspected culture played a major role in shaping people's age beliefs, and I wanted to know if age beliefs, in turn, have a demonstrable impact on longevity. She wrote in her book, Breaking the Age Code. To find out, she turned to an enormous set of data from the Ohio Longitudinal Study on Aging and Retirement, which had tracked the trajectories of more than 1,000 participants since the mid-1970s. To measure attitudes toward aging, the study's founders had asked their participants to state whether they agreed with a series of statements such as, things keep getting worse as I get older. I have as much pep as I did last year. And as you get older, you're less useful. When Levy and her colleagues examined the fates of these people, they found that someone's beliefs could predict their overall risk of death over the following years. On average, someone with a rosier view of aging lived for around 7.5 more years than those who were more pessimistic, even after the researchers had controlled for factors like socioeconomic status, loneliness, and their health at the start of the study. The size of the effect was larger than the other well-established lifestyle factors. Differences in blood pressure and cholesterol, for instance, can only count for around 4 or so years in someone's longevity. If a previously unidentified virus was found to diminish life expectancy by over 7 years, considerable effort would probably be devoted to identifying the cause and implementing a remedy, Levy and her co-authors concluded. Physical differences in the brain. As you might expect, the finding caused something of a media storm, and many similarly eye-catching discoveries soon followed. In 2009, for instance, Levy and her colleagues turned to data from the Baltimore Longitudinal Study of Aging, which began in 1958. They found that measures of people's attitudes to aging, taken before they turned 50, could strongly predict the risk of heart disease up to 38 years later. In the late 2010s, meanwhile, Levy turned her attention to Alzheimer's disease, showing that people with positive attitudes towards aging were considerably less likely to develop dementia. The differences were not only visible in their scores and cognitive tests, but also could be seen in physical differences in the brain. Research on aging mindsets has now reached a kind of tipping point, with a formal review of the evidence revealing more than 100 papers on the topic. About 80% show an effect, says Professor Hans Werner Wall at Heidelberg University, Germany, who was an author of the paper. How our mindset might influence aging. The huge question hanging over all this research is, of course, the mechanism linking our thoughts to our biology. How on earth could the contents of our minds influence the aging of our bodies to such a large degree? Skeptics would argue that it doesn't, and that what we're really seeing is reverse correlation. Worse health leads people to form more pessimistic views, while people with greater physical vitality are going to feel more positive. It's a very reasonable concern, but it doesn't reflect the course of events seen in the longitudinal studies, which had attempted to control for this possibility. In general, the attitudes about aging were measured years before the changes in health had started to emerge. Most researchers would argue that the link is bidirectional, which means that someone's mindset can influence their health, but their health can also influence their mindset in a kind of constant feedback loop. So we can infer some level of causality. Stereotype embodiment among older people. As at the heart of this lies a process known as stereotype embodiment, how we internalize societal stereotypes, and has three main pathways. The first is psychological. We begin to think, feel, and act according to the script that our society assigns to a group, in this case, older people. Research suggests that priming people with negative age stereotypes can make them more forgetful, for instance, and leads them to feel less confident in their physical strength. Levy has observed this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy firsthand. In Breaking the Age Code, she recalls her grandmother having an altercation with the owner of a grocery store after she had tripped over a wooden crate. "It's not my fault that old people fall down all the time," he told her when she complained. "Maybe you shouldn't be walking around." For the next few days, Levy's grandmother stopped driving and began asking her family for more help around the house. She seemed to be reliving the grocery owner's words and questioning her competency as an older person in a way she never had before, Levy recalls. The second pathway concerns our longer-term behaviors. The fatalistic view that we face an inevitable decline can lead someone to take less care of their health. If you can't influence your chance of getting a disease, then what's the point of following a healthy diet, training at the gym, or sleeping for 7 or 8 hours a night, says Sabatini. Someone who sees the potential for growth in their golden years will take more steps to preserve their well-being so that they can make the most of those opportunities. Finally, there's a physiological pathway. When we lose confidence in our abilities, small challenges such as adapting to new technology or attending a party with people we don't know can create a lot of anxiety, resulting in chronic stress. Levy has found that people's cortisol levels rise by roughly 40% from their 50th to 80th birthdays if they have negative attitudes to aging. Those with positive views, in contrast, show a slight decline in cortisol over the same period as they settle into their next stage of life. Over the years, heightened cortisol can have a negative impact on the hippocampus, on the immune system, and our cardiovascular system, says Wall. The heightened anxiety that comes from negative views of aging can also trigger heightened inflammation. In the short term, this can help us to fight infections, but it can cause bodily wear and tear in the long term, which speeds up our biological aging. Stereotype embodiment may be especially important for recovery after an initial injury. Hill, for example, has found that those who view their age as a handicap are considerably less likely to regain their vigor and independence following a fall. Reframing what aging means. With this large body of evidence behind them, many scientists are now examining how we can use stereotype embodiment to our advantage. As I explained in my book, The Expectation Effect, our mindsets are incredibly malleable. We now know that teaching people about adaptive benefits of stress can help them cope better with new challenges. So recall when he says, my book, this is David Robson. Learning that a racing heart, an uncomfortable symptom of anxiety, means more oxygen is reaching the brain, helps students deal with their exam nerves, for instance. The Aging Plus Project at Colorado State University took a similar approach to changing people's attitudes toward aging. The participants in the intervention, with an average age of 60, were given a 4-week course that was designed to increase their physical activity. Unlike other fitness regimes, however, the modules also explained how to identify and question some of the most negative assumptions about aging, including the common beliefs that senior citizens are frail and absent-minded. To reinforce these ideas, they were taught concepts such as neuroplasticity, the brain's capacity to adapt and change throughout our lives, alongside practical strategies to adopt new fitness goals. For comparison, a second group of participants was given some general education about general lifestyle changes that could maintain good health into old age. As hoped, those taking the Aging Plus program started exercising more than those in the control group, and this coincided with some important changes to their mindsets. By the end of the course, they were less likely to endorse statements such as, it's normal to be depressed when you're old, and the human body is like a car. When it gets old, it gets worn out. Less likely to endorse those statements. They also felt more empowered to control their trajectory, which was reflected in their responses to statements such as, no matter what point in life you're at, you can always influence your own aging. Importantly, the degree to which someone's mindset changed could predict how much they exercised over the following weeks. The positive attitudes to aging proved to be a strong motivator for healthier behavior. In the future, it'll be interesting to see the long-term health effects of these interventions on people's cortisol levels, inflammation, and overall risk of disease. A change of attitude. If you feel inspired, Levy's book provides many tips on the ways we might change our mindsets. She suggests keeping a portfolio of positive role models from books, documentaries, or news items, for instance. You might look to someone like actor Judi Dench, who won an Oscar at 64 and has continued to practice her art into her 80s, or the Japanese triathlete Hiromu Inada, who recently completed a 70.3-mile Ironman event in Cairns, Australia at the age of 92. You may also learn how to question your assumptions about unpleasant events or challenges. An act of absent-mindedness could be the simple result of distraction in a busy life. Similarly, many aches or pains may be a natural consequence of physical activity that could occur to anyone. The true cause may have nothing to do with age, Levy says, and we can make a habit of looking for those other explanations. Changing our attitudes will not only prepare us for a happier, healthier view of aging, it may also help the people around us. We should be careful about the way we talk to our friends and relatives, for example. Ageism is the last socially acceptable form of discrimination, says Hill. He points out that one can still buy many greeting cards with jokes that simply reinforce negative age stereotypes, for instance. And this humor is common in many everyday conversations. Even well-meaning attempts to help could backfire if they undermine someone's independence or agency. We can focus on what people can do, such as walking, gardening, and socializing, Hill says. That could boost confidence and a sense of control. Ultimately, we need a larger cultural shift that treats ageism like any other prejudice. We can target individuals, and we can target specific groups of individuals who may be at greater risk, says Sabatini. But we also need to change the narrative at the societal level. Whether you're 40, 60, or 80, your future health and happiness may come to depend on it. So part of healthy aging is getting enough sleep. And this next article is a question that was posed to the Harvard Health Newsletter, to the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. And the question is, I'm trying to get my sleep apnea under control, but I can't get used to my CPAP. What else should I try? And the answer? Continuous positive airway pressure, or CPAP, devices are considered the most effective treatment for obstructive sleep apnea, known as OSA. But it can take time to adjust to using one. Ask your healthcare team for help tinkering with the fit, or ask if it's possible to try a different style. If that doesn't work, don't give up. Your healthcare team has many other treatment options they can help you explore. Some strategies focus on keeping your airway open during sleep. Others support weight loss, which can help reduce OSA severity. Oral appliances like a mouth guard gently reposition the jaw or tongue to keep the airway open during sleep. Many people find these more comfortable and convenient than CPAP, but they may not be enough for more severe OSA. You might benefit from therapies that stimulate your strengthen the airway muscles. The best known of these is hypoglossal nerve stimulation, which uses an implanted device to stimulate the tongue muscles to keep the airway open. This option removes the need for masks and mouthpieces, but is reserved for moderate to severe OSA in people who have certain airway issues and do not tolerate CPAP. The stimulation device is surgically placed, which carries its own risks. Medications may also play a role in treating OSA. Drugs such as tirzepatide, known as Zepbound, work by supporting weight loss, which reduces the amount of pressure on the airways. Other drugs are being studied that keep airway muscles active during sleep and may reduce side effects such as waking too often. If other treatments aren't effective, surgery may be worth considering. Procedures can be done to reposition the jaw, remove tissue that blocks breathing, or promote weight loss. These procedures may reduce OSA symptoms and improve other aspects of health, but they carry surgical risks, and you may still need a CPAP or other treatment afterward. No matter which treatment you choose, your care team also may recommend practical steps to help your therapy work its best. These may include sleeping on your side to keep your airway open, managing nasal congestion, avoiding alcohol or sedatives before bed, and quitting smoking. Well, that's all we have time for in today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next week. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Deborah Love, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, NorthCarolinaReadingService.org. If you have comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. I'd love to hear from you. That number again is 919-832-5138. As always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.